Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am your host, founder and CEO of Literal Humans, Paul David. And I'm joined today by another founder and CEO, Kim Smith, the founder and CEO of Health Evolve.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Today, we're going to be talking about bridging the gap in maternal health equity. Kim's done an incredible job, and I'm really looking forward to digging in because we've learned a lot about Health Evolve over the past few months. By way of introduction, they're a software company that's on a mission to improve maternal health outcomes by centering chronic disease management using AI-enabled monitoring and personalized care management support. Kim has over 18 years of leadership experience in major hospital systems, including MUSC Health and Tenet Healthcare. She's driven by a deeply personal commitment to addressing health disparities. She's now leveraging her expertise in healthcare analytics and femtech to amplify community voices and transform how we deliver care to women. Welcome to the pod, Kim.
Thank you.
So, we'll love to try to start out with, you know, having our guests just paint a picture of the landscape. So help our audience understand why this intersection of care and culture is the key to kind of closing health equity gaps. And if you can, talk about the patient voice as one of the most underrated commodities in healthcare and how you're sort of looking to capture and elevate that voice to change clinical outcomes.
Absolutely. That's such a powerful question to start off with. And what I would offer is when I think about the word care, I often, as a healthcare administrator, I know we typically associate that with the quality, right? The quality of work, the outcomes, right? That we're expecting healthy moms, healthy babies, ideally. And when I think about the word culture, I often think about how that care is delivered. What is the culture of the organizations? What are their understanding of how to be culturally responsive? What is their understanding of what happens beyond the walls of the clinic or the hospital that you have to think through or be thoughtful of when delivering that care? So it's the what and the how combined in my mind in terms of care and culture. And to me, the voice of the patient is at the center of that. It's at the center of it informs you of, yes, the potential barriers to providing great care, right? If they have comorbidities or they don't have access to food. And then it's also the voice of letting them know that they need to be heard. They need to be listened to from a cultural perspective. They need to be a part of the care team. So the patient's voice, that mom's voice, is at the center of everything when we think about improving the health of women and children, specifically improving the health of birthing women. So hopefully that makes sense. But I feel like you have to have all three to really move the needle in the outcomes that we're seeing in the U.S., which are not pretty.
Yeah. And you use the phrase culturally responsive, which I think, you know, has become a bit of a buzzword. And, you know, I guess like let's dig into that. And how do you actually give that shape and give that structure and make sure that, you know, culturally responsive care actually manifests in the technology that you're building, but also the outcomes that you're seeking to achieve?
Absolutely. And I appreciate that we'll talk about it from a technology perspective, but I can certainly speak on what that looks like in the traditional healthcare setting or what it should look like. But when I think about it from a technology perspective, it starts with how you build. Right? Ensuring that the technology is inclusive. So with Health Evolve in particular, we use a digital health equity framework to build our flagship solution, Lauren. And what that means is we partnered with birthing women in communities, both urban and rural remote areas. We partnered directly with the nurses, the people that would use the tool, with our physicians. It was really a multidisciplinary and it reflected the ecosystem, right, of understanding what specifically needs to be built, how should it be used, who wants to use it, what's most important to them, what are their pain points, and testing, doing UX design testing with really all of those individuals, but definitely the end user on the app side, and ensuring that we address their needs. So part of that may be making sure that there's the right set of languages that you've embedded in, that we recognize that everyone may not even if you're fluent, obviously, if Spanish is your first language, it may be that you prefer audio over reading translated text. Google hosted a phenomenal inclusive product design summit a few years ago, right before we started building Lauren. And I attended that and got so much of a depth of understanding of how to truly have inclusive design. So when I think about culturally responsive, of course, let's say you do all these things. To me, culturally responsive is understanding that the iteration process never ends. It means that you are constantly pressure testing what you produce and including and adding more functionality that ensures that everyone can access your tool that is your ideal client, right? So it may mean that, okay, we need to expand by another 20 languages because we've found that we're in a market where a few languages aren't recognized as maybe a top language that you're used to in healthcare, but for your particular target population, we have a 20% Russian population in a particular area, and you didn't even think about Russian. It means that you go back, you respond to what people need, and that is your culture. Your culture actually reflects that of being responsive to the needs of your end users or patients or whatever you want to call them, your participants, your members, on an ongoing basis, and they're always a part of your journey. So that would be my thought on that.
I love that notion of like the iteration process never ends and the connection. I've not heard people talk about the connection between your culture, like as an organization or, you know, and as someone delivering care and the way it manifests in your product developments, you know, and like your cultural principles show up there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, who you are as an organization is reflected in how people experience you. And we know that in hospitals, you know, and we use a lot of buzzwords in hospitals for sure. But we believe that, we really believe that who you are as an organization should be reflected on how both your employees experience you as well as your end users, not one or the other. And so I took that to heart with building out Health Evolve Technologies.
It's a great segue into, I wanted to ask you about your experience. Like obviously, you know, you've worked in these massive systems like Tenet and Duke, and I imagine maybe you had a few kind of light bulb moments that started to convince you like, hey, I need to start something that's like a, you know, more nimble, more flexible to kind of, you know, respond to those needs that you were seeing maybe not being met in the system. So yeah, tell us about maybe what were a few of those moments in your experience working in those systems that pointed you towards starting Health Evolve and addressing the maternal health crisis?
Absolutely. So I would say I had two different kind of streams of thought. I never actually planned to be a full-time entrepreneur. That was not my plan. I planned to be a hospital CEO, and I'm still surprised that I'm doing this today sometimes. But there are a few things that excited me about working in those systems because I love healthcare. I mean, this has been my whole life. I spent my whole career in healthcare. And one of the things that I really got excited about that I didn't want to move away from was working at a macro level. So I've worked in smaller federally qualified health centers, right? Those are small community-based settings, or in some countries, they might be referred to as like charity-based organizations. I worked in those spaces. I worked for regional hospital systems that are across one state. And I've worked for a national organization like Tenet, which is a Fortune 500, in a national role. So in that role, I spent years traveling to our 24 markets, expanding, looking at all of our thousands of hospitals and leaders at a macro level and helping them to strengthen and grow and build, right? I was a builder, and ensuring that they also not only built, but they trained their leaders on how to prepare for growth. So that was really my job in a nutshell. And I love that. I love it. It was really hard. It was a tough market, not market, but for-profit healthcare is a little tough. I'll say that. But I was there for many years and left when I wanted to go back into a regional executive role during the middle of the pandemic. But I learned so much. And I would say my excitement for that macro level, looking at many hospitals and comparing the notes, I loved it. And it wasn't necessarily me as a consultant. I was an insider. I was a partner in care, even though I didn't have my panel of patients I was studying in terms of outcomes. I looked at a system level. So that excited me. And going back to a regional role, I realized, man, I don't think I like being in a smaller system. I think I like being in a big system. But what I didn't realize is I really like seeing many, many systems and looking at best practices. And I really found that out with Health Evolve. But my pathway to maternal health started 14 years ago when I was working in healthcare, and in a smaller setting. But I was pregnant with my first daughter, Lauren, and we ended up losing Lauren due to a high risk hypertensive disorder of pregnancy. And
really sorry.
And I was on this journey for years, not planning to be an entrepreneur, but advocating. And I would say that unlocked my passion for improving health outcomes. So what's interesting, I think my passion for that macro level view, merged with my passion for healthy moms and babies. And I said, I don't want to stay in the same system. If anything, I need to leave the systems and figure out how do we create a new approach to care delivery. And now I'm excited because I get to look at what is this doctor doing in this state? And okay, let's talk about some future partners. We're working on cultivating some partnerships in Illinois. And now we're working on a partnership in South London. So I get to kind of do all the things, if that makes sense, both adhere to that passion for improving outcomes as well as have this macro level global seat in the process.
Well, first things first, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. And also, I think it's so beautiful, like what you've done from that. And like you've named it, you know, after your child, and you've built something, like you've been your target audience, and you're looking to serve them because that's born of that experience. So I think that's so beautiful. And thank you for that. It's so amazing to see people like, you know, take something that was so difficult and then say, hey, I'm going to help other folks, you know, and that's entrepreneurship at its finest, I think. So let's talk about Lauren. You know, you have this platform that kind of looks to extend the care village, as you call it, beyond the clinic walls. We'd love for you to give our audience kind of a walkthrough of the user journey and help us understand, you know, how it integrates this kind of remote patient monitoring for things like blood pressure with like the personal care navigator experience. Just kind of take us on the journey there.
Absolutely. I'm so proud of what our team has been able to build with Lauren. We've been behind the curtain, I would say, like really like farmers with our sleeves rolled up in the soil, preparing for the growth, and it's really paying off. So with Lauren, we've designed it as a full circle digital health solution. It's designed to support women across a full 100 weeks of care. And what that looks like is whether the woman, let me pause and say, we've now extended to preconception all the way to early parenting. So going into that 18, 24 month period, which is exciting. But how do people get access to Lauren? Of course, women may be invited by their employer or their health plan, or even potentially their provider to access Lauren. So the user journey looks like them receiving an email invitation saying, our organization is now partnering with Lauren by Health Evolve, and you can access the solutions as well as a certified women's health specialist on your journey of improved optimal health. They would click the link to download the Lauren app. Within that download, they would be prompted to answer a few assessment questions, order their cuff kit or glucose monitor that's drop shipped to their home. And then they would begin tracking their journey and getting some education. And what's excited about the education is we've created an AI-enabled curriculum that is, of course, our curriculum supports women across this entire journey, including things on preeclampsia and diabetes and stress and social needs and even grief, recognizing that, unfortunately, some of us may experience some empty arms leaving the hospital. But with the AI, we use an ACE framework where women can receive their very personalized learning path based on what we know about them, based on their data. So this is really closed AI, right? It's our tool. We just use some really good logic to present to them specifically what is relevant to them. Because if you're not diabetic, then you don't need all the diabetes curriculum, right? So it's exciting. And all of that data, all of those insights are shared in real time with our Lauren web portal. So your clinical team, or even in concert with our certified women's health specialist, if that's a part of the agreement, can see you in the work queue. It's a full telemedicine platform. We have video chat, real-time translation built into Lauren, which I call Lauren 2.0. And it's exciting because what happens is, you know, one of our physician partners said during our summit a few weeks ago that women in total will spend 6 hours with their provider during pregnancy, provider, mid-level, anyone up through birth, right? This is not including the delivery and the hospital time. So you got 6 hours, right? They have less than 16 touch points if you're high risk with a provider. So what we do is we fill in the gap. We are engaging with you continuously in between those visits. And then when the drop off happens, which I call the black hole after 6 weeks postpartum, no one's really paying attention to the mom. That's still a peak time of maternal mortality. That's when you're going back to work, potentially, at least in the U.S., unfortunately. The average is 2 weeks postpartum, and everyone's focusing on the baby. But you've got a lot of risk factors. You've got a lot happening within your body that someone needs to be paying attention to. And then maybe you get back to your family physician at 12 months postpartum. Mm. Well, our job with Lauren is to be there for you the entire time. to help you transition after birth back to work, back to your family medicine physician, and then also address any chronic disease issues or comorbidities that have come up on that entire journey, and to help you also with your parenting. So it's a redesign, because our systems are not designed, for a lot of reasons, but they're not designed for the OB to be with you forever. Eventually, these folks go away. But who is with mom when she needs the care the most? So that's the experience of Lauren.
You're really addressing like the holes, and as you said, like the black holes, the gaps in the system, and creating this really long tail of support that, you know, is just kind of tackling some of the critical junctures and the real life experience of, mothers. So I think that's incredible. So it's very clear how that's happening in the lives of the women that you're supporting. I'm very interested in like the sort of structural impact that you're having. So you're giving, you know, better data and sort of understanding of the real world challenges that affects maternal health outside of the clinic to doctors and insurance companies and physicians and researchers. So like, help us understand, you know, the sort of structural impact that you're having from, you know, down to the individual level, but also understanding, you know, the trends that you're seeing in the data. That to me is incredibly interesting. And there's a huge potential for impact there. So tell us about that.
Absolutely. And in some ways I've been saying for a few years, we're just getting started, because it feels like we're just at the tip of the iceberg, truly, with unlocking the full value of our platform. But I will say, so far, there has been a lot of excitement. So we're based, our headquarters is in South Carolina and in Southeast, in the Stroke Belt, in a state that has really high chronic disease numbers for birthing women. So the fact that a South Carolina-based health tech company, and the founder happens to have a lived experience with this in a hospital background, is birthed this in our state. There's been a lot of excitement in the state of South Carolina and in the Southeast about Lauren. And what's exciting is the timing of it. Organizations are in this transformation kind of process. And this, I don't want to use buzzwords, but they really are trying to redesign how they approach care. But their challenge is the payment model. The challenge is, I'm paid to do this way. So how do I step outside of what's traditionally the model to do something innovative that I don't get paid for? So OBs don't get paid, right? They don't get paid to see birthing women after that 6-week appointment. That is best practice. They hand off now to your family physician. But what if you need the cardiologist in the time? You know, what if something happens in between? What this creates, and what there's a lot of active conversations around, is reimagining the connection through that full continuum of care. We talk about that a lot in hospitals, and I can share other examples later, but there are a lot of people at the table building with us within these systems. So we are in the midst of our clinical validation study with a hospital. It's the largest academic hospital. Actually, they produce the most babies. So they're the largest provider of obstetric care in the state of South Carolina. And we produce about 57,000 births a year, particularly in our state. Even though it's a smaller state, that's still a good number. We're growing. We are direct partners with the University of South Carolina, which is the data steward. They have 50 years worth of birth data. These are our friends. And everyone knows about Project Lauren. They're building with us. We're looking at adding in additional, I would say, risk models around the risk of severe maternal morbidity. So we're able to share some meaningful information with them, right? The data we're able to share is not just the clinical data, and it's not just the social data. We're able to give them literacy data. We're able to give them behavioral change data, and they don't have that today. And we're able to give it to them on a continuous basis. And I realized that, especially with our summit where we did a showcase of Lauren for the first time publicly with our partners, I could see the eyeballs kind of light up, because they're starting to get it. So, of course, we got some exciting partners, and we get a lot of help. We get a lot of grants, and we'll soon be announcing more of our deployments with Lauren as well. We're literally in the midst of one right now where people need that data. They need all four of those types of data, because you don't have it today. So a simple example of why literacy is important. You hand pamphlets to birthing women about preeclampsia, right? Can you translate whether that education, whether they understood it, and then whether there's a connection between them understanding this education and future outcomes?
Yeah.
So you're able to measure even your community programs, and we can digitize anything for you and use AI to drive it. So in understanding that, they realize, oh, this is a big deal, and they don't have the resources to do it themselves. So I had to share.
No, that's great. I mean, and it mirrors like what we're seeing with other health tech companies we're working with. What one of them is kind of like an AI social worker that's largely telephonic, right? And like making the decision to be telephonic for ease of use, but also literacy concerns and, you know, just like meeting, you know, the end user where they are. And just being honest about, okay, what's going to be the most impactful and help us reach folks and,
yes.
and not build, you know, for ourselves, but build for, you know, the folks who are going to be using our product. So
absolutely.
Would love to jump into growth strategy. We're a growth strategy agency. You know that we'd be remiss if we didn't talk to you about how you're scaling. And we really want to understand our audience is interested in kind of your roadmap for scaling this kind of community powered technology in what's a largely complex, you know, payer provider landscape. So I'd love to hear about particularly two things, like scaling a high tech solution in rural areas where sometimes infrastructure can be a bit limited or traditional, and also navigating these like long sales cycles that a lot of insurance companies have. But also, you know, you want to stay agile as a young startup. So talk to us about your growth obstacles and how you're thinking about those.
Yes, I had to, such a powerful question. I had to pull some tools from my toolbox, right? As a, just a growth person in the hospital setting. And I, what I thought about was the fact that most big systems, they have multiple pathways. You can't be distracted, but they have pretty distinct revenue lines, right? Or service lines, whatever you want to call them, because some will feed your big revenue. So for example, surgeries, right, are your profit center, your time in the OR, but they don't come out of nowhere. They come from primary care referrals, but primary care doesn't make as much money, right, as your surgeries. So how to balance, but you have to have both, right? You have to have both. And even when you build something new, it can take a number of years to really experience your full return on your investment, whether you're building a surgery center or whatever. So I was thinking back on what have I built in the hospital setting? How did we balance revenue? How do we balance profit margin and a good EBITDA? Or even starting out, and we're starting off from scratch, right, with nothing. So, and what is our design? What do we want to be known for? So I took all that into account and I intentionally built a research and community partnerships division to balance out our build for technology. The main reason is because we are not just Silicon Valley technologists. Sorry to those that are, no offense to you, but that's not who we are. We are physicians and engineers and social scientists and so forth that have a lived experience with this, that happen to connect in and use tech as our solution to address the problem. So that means we're evidence-based. We're clinicians. So we're evidence-based. So having research as a core part of our organization is really important as thought leaders, and also it helps us drive and build the system the correct way. And that actually has become a profit center for us on our journey. So whether that's being able to secure state contracts and government contracts, that also is used to fund and build out our technology. We've been able to create a profit center that helps to fund our growth as well as we are navigating those long sales cycles, right? Because just like primary care fee surgeries, our research in our profit center helps to feed our technology. Yeah. And so for us, we're looking at employers. Of course, I'm a hospital baby, right? come from that world. And so we have our provider section. We have our health plans that we're talking with. We're in sales cycles with them now, but we also are in sales cycles with employers that are really keen on investing, and specifically employer-sponsored benefit plans that are investing in the health of their people because of productivity concerns, because of also the cost of replacing is extremely high, depending on the, really for everyone, but especially as you go up in leadership, it becomes more and more expensive. So, and you want to do it in a way that's cost effective, right? So we are having some really exciting conversations with both employers and health plans, as well as hospital systems that are interested in deploying Lauren. And the way we've designed our portal, we're agile enough to be able to do all three of those. We're going to learn within the next year which of those paths, which of those client types are our beachhead. Mm-hmm. We're going to learn that. So that's the journey we're on. But I think it's important to have a level of agility as you're starting out as a startup, because you don't know. The market is shifting as we speak.
Rapidly, yeah.
You don't know, is it going to be employer? Is it going to be health plan? Is it going to be the provider space because of all the changes and cuts?
Yeah.
But when you mention rural, of course, we're never going to leave behind rural. Some of those examples of those enterprise clients, several touch rural, not all of them do. But one thing we're ensuring to maintain with our rural connection is through our including that in our research and community partnerships division. So we're always deploying in rural, whether that's through a straight contract, through a grant, through the health plan that touches the rural. We will never leave rural America behind. And that's how we balance our impact story in all of this as well. So it's feeding us, but it's also assuring we experience that impact story that we want to experience.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I'm hearing so much about partnerships and research and, you know, data, like evidence-based practice. Like, we're getting a lot of folks come across and say, like, help us build a partnerships ecosystem platform and, you know, content that's driven by that research and things like that to bring in more partnerships and to nurture partnerships. So you're hitting the nail on the head in terms of like what we're seeing in the market as well.
Awesome.
That's really cool. And also the profit center thing, like, you know, we're thinking the same way. We work with loads of health tech companies. So why not turn all of that data and insights we have from working with great health tech companies like yourselves into a profit center, into insights reports and a data repository and a data warehouse that folks can buy into and benefit from and then grow their practice out of it. So really love what you're doing there. That's amazing. We'd love to jump into just a question or two about your personal journey. You've had this 18-year journey in hospital leadership that's kind of shaped your approach to entrepreneurship. You've been kind of a senior director and a VP. Now you're a founder. That's a big, big shift. Would be curious about some of the most surprising lessons that you learned about leadership that maybe you didn't necessarily get in the corporate world that have kind of, you know, come across your radar as an entrepreneur. And also, you know, how do you like as your own self, like protect your mental energy and try to evolve every day as you say, but you're while carrying the weight of such a critical mission. So what's your big lesson and how do you protect your mental energy? Small questions.
Oh, goodness. You have the best questions. Man, what I will say is anyone that was in a leadership seat during the middle of the COVID pandemic got a few extra lessons, right? And I just happened to be in that seat before I left to launch Health Evolve in 2023. But, you know, what's interesting is I knew in leadership and in hospital and medical leadership that I tend to work faster than the average person, I'll say, meaning that sometimes I can see things that are 3 or 5 years out and I work to find the shortest point between here and there at a speed that sometimes my staff didn't always keep up with.
I can relate to that so hard, Kim. I just wanted to say, I'm always saying to my staff, I'm like, whenever you hear me talking, I'm talking about tomorrow. Like, just assume that I'm talking about tomorrow. And it's just like, and it's really hard. It doesn't come from any place of like boastfulness or anything like that. You're not like, oh, I'm focused.
It's just how your brain works.
Yeah. Like my brain's connections. Yeah. And like, it's weird to say I'm a visionary, but I know what you mean. Like
That's why I didn't say that in the beginning.
It's fine.
Because it sounds like I don't know what it sounds like, but it's everyone has a different skill, right? When you put the right people in the right seats within an organization, it should be through an intentional design of your skills. And I know that's one of my skills. And part of it probably was birthed from having to be a builder in healthcare. I always had to anticipate risk. I always had to build out plans and have foresight 3 to 4 years out for projects and issues. And it's just, and I'm an operator. So I think that's just how I've been trained to think for many years.
I think my kids are teaching, like thinking about 30 kids in a classroom and like who's going to react to what and what's not going to go well for so-and-so, but might work for, like, you got to think about this stuff and it kind of, it codes you.
That's right. Like our veterans, when you go into, I hear some of them, when they go into any building, any room, they immediately look for the exits. Like their brain.
Yeah.
Everyone has that. It's whatever that is for you, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew that would be a challenging corporate. And I really worked to speak vision and to really deposit things, give them the opportunity to express their vision and build. And I became a builder with them. I really was intentional about positioning people to strengthen that skill, especially if they're my directors. And a lot of them, I was able to promote people into their first director role and they've been soaring and I also was very compassionate. I mean, I didn't expect them to be me. If that makes sense. I guess that's compassion because I feel like some people have unrealistic expectations for leaders. But when I went into, but I had infrastructure already in the corporate space. I had a lot of help. And when I became a founder and a CEO, and I started pulling the team together, I realized some people could run with the vision faster than others. And some people that I thought could run faster didn't initially. And I realized I need to figure out how to connect the vision with them. Like, how do they learn? How do they get it? Because I know they have all the things they need to get it. But I'm not translating this in a way where either it's a knowledge gap or it's a confidence. It's one or the other. It's one of the two, right?
In education, we call it scaffolding. You know, like you have to like, you know, some people need, yeah, it's like such a good term, right? Like scaffolding people into, okay, how am I going to get this person to the floor that they need, that I know they can get to? I got to build exactly. with them for them. Yeah, I think
you got to build with them. Yeah. But in the founder space, it takes so much more patience because you are running like your life depends on it. One, because you don't want to run out of a runway in terms of cash. Because when you run out of cash, you're dead in the water.
Yep.
And there's also a lot of time limitations that people just put on you as a founder. Like you've got to use these credits for, you know, if you're building the cloud by a certain time, you can't get access to this funding if you're this many years old. Right. You are expected to do XYZ if you want to do traditional funding with a bank. So you have to have certain milestones within a certain period of time. And I didn't know the level of speed that you had to operate with on many work streams to just be in the groove of the market. Like you're getting on the interstate and you're like, oh gosh, I'm used to driving 25 and everyone's going 80. This is the Autobahn. So, and everyone can keep up with that. So you have to also figure out a way to slow down just enough to bring them along and to position them. And then say, sometimes you got to jump out in the middle of the speedway and just try. Sometimes you just got to go. I got baptized by fire many times as a 20-year-old leader. And then HR execs would laugh and say, okay, she survived that. Let's give her something else. Like, this is my hospital journey. I was a young leader, really, really young leader.
Yeah.
And we're managing big departments and systems that I had no idea what I was doing, but they let me jump in and be baptized by fire, and I survived it and found what I loved with a lot of bruises, but that's how they did it back in the day, I guess 20 years ago. But so with my leaders, I've learned you got to slow down enough, but then also be okay if they're in the wrong seat or be okay if it's not their time. And that's the hardest part.
That's the hardest.
Because you feel like you've invested so much. But I'm so grateful that for our team, they've just risen to the occasion, or they've fallen in love with the vision. It's uncomfortable, but I also tell them, realize that I'm learning too, and realize that I'm uncomfortable too. But my mentor when I was 18, who's on my board, John McCullough, said, you got to be okay. You got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. So I've been uncomfortable for the past 20 years. I think that's what people don't realize. I'm always uncomfortable.
I think people don't have like enough, you know, and say this about founders, like we're sort of a very privileged bunch, right? But like enough like empathy and understanding for the way we have to think about time and like pace and speed and how we're not only thinking about that for the organization, but for every single person within it. And this idea of like leadership is disappointing people at a rate they can tolerate, but also moving them forward at a rate that they can accept, you know?
And I need to write that down.
Yeah, like I was moving way too fast or way too slow or just right, which is rare. And so everything you're saying really, really resonates there. I love that reflection and appreciate you sharing it. Well, listen.
Go ahead. Myself, I guess I'll mention, I'm learning to do this better in terms of how to create white space for myself. But I've done something I'm very proud of. I want to put it on record for my friend who hopefully will listen to this podcast. But I used to work in corporate to the point of becoming sick. Like I did. It was not healthy, the level of intensity that I would work. And then I realized it's never enough. So you got to figure out a way to really calm it back. I'm not sure if it was just a fear. I was driven by fear or a need for success or what. It probably was more so fear than anything, a failure. But I worked to the point of being sick and I did the same thing. And it was worse. I would burn out faster. Because you don't have this level of health. So what I did, one of my friends, and then the thing is, I'm helping women have better heart health, and I'm a survivor.
Oh, gosh.
I can't have high blood pressure and all these things because from stress, which I had a little spike even recently. I'm like, oh, no. I've got to live and walk the talk. So one of my friends has always recommended what's called a Power 24. And the Power 24 is, she does this once a quarter. She'll go to, she'll just get away from her family, from work, everyone. It's just her for a solo trip. And it doesn't have to be big. It can be small. You can go somewhere that's local to a local boutique hotel. You can go out of town. You can go to the mountains wherever you want. And it is just for you to have white space to just have your thoughts. Yeah, and as I'm a mom of, I've got three boys, right? And a husband. I've wear a lot of hats and I usually don't have any quiet time. And when I am by myself, that doesn't mean, and it sounds quiet, my head is just beating so fast with all the things. So I scheduled my first Power 24. It's actually next week.
Oh, amazing. Congrats.
Now, I'm secretly taking my husband just because he does call me now. He's an accountant, so he's not going to, he's not going to add to my stress. If anything, he's going to tell me to calm down. He'll make sure that I don't work. So
that's great.
And it's just, I'll be doing that consistently. And then I also have a monthly mental health day. I did not take it the past 3 years. Okay. It was on my calendar, but somehow it still worked. Guess what? I'm taking my monthly mental health day just to breathe and also checking my blood pressure, drinking lots of water, adding fun things like chia pudding to my usual morning routine, which I love. I actually make a really good chia pudding.
Yeah.
Things to take care of me.
Yeah. No, it's a good test for the team too. Like whenever I take days, I'm like, okay, this is signals to the team that I'm taking care of myself and that, this thing is bigger than me and should be. And, that it needs to run on its own because the vision is, and the mission is bigger than each of us. But I love that. And we'll share some details about Power 24 in the episode description so folks can latch on and take their own mental health days and Power 24 days. I'm afraid we'll have to cut it there. I want to give you some time back and let you get back to things, but this has been a fantastic episode. We've got 41 great minutes here. I really love this episode, Kim, because I think the bridge building that you're doing between this kind of high level world of maternal health and hospital administration, connecting it to the very deeply personal and local needs of mothers, soon-to-be mothers. You know, I think you're proving that technology isn't just a tool for efficiency, but it's a vehicle for empathy and equity. And I think you're delivering that with Health Evolve and Lauren. So just want to thank you and let our listeners know, where can they learn more about Health Evolve on the interwebs?
Yes, definitely connect with us. Our website is healthevolve.co. So definitely you can connect with us there. We're also on LinkedIn at, of course, Health Evolve there, and Instagram, the typical channels, as well as TikTok if you're a TikToker. But would love for you all to connect with us and join our listserv or come to one of our upcoming events.
Nice. And we'll include all those links in the episode description, so folks, look out for that. And as always, this has been another great episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We've been joined today by Kim Smith, the founder and CEO of Health Evolve, talking about bridging the gap in maternal health equity. As always, give us a review, give us a 5-star rating so we can keep bringing amazing founders like Kim onto the show. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.